Today is July 23rd, 2014. This is Desiree Hargis on behalf of the H.J. Lucher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, today I'm interviewing Stephen Colgate over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. Steve, can you begin with when and where you were born?
I was born in New York City in 1935.
And can you tell me a little bit about your family and where you grew up?
My family was wealthy, I guess, until it wasn't. My father actually was in the 1936 Olympics in bobsledding. And it never occurred to me, I mean, I wasn't trying to match my father or anything like that, but the Olympics was on my mind, obviously as a pinnacle of sport, and so I guess that may have been some motivation. I remember my sister and I up in the attic one time finding some old 16 millimeter film. We had a projector there, so we turned on the projector, and there was Hitler giving a speech before the Winter Olympics. Of course, the Winter and the Summer Olympics were all the same year back then. So that was quite interesting for me. I have no idea what happened to those movies.
That is really interesting. So what was the first sport or athletic pursuit that you became involved in? The very earliest one. Yeah, the earliest athletic pursuit that you pursued.
I was probably track and field in New York City in a school named Buckley. And then I went to a St. Paul's school in Concord, New Hampshire, and got involved with soccer and hockey, ice hockey. So that really turned me on, the ice hockey. In 1955, just after school and in Yale, I was able to go on a transatlantic sailboat race from Havana, Cuba to San Sebastian, Spain, and that turned me on to sailing in a big way. So that became my life and something I really wanted to do and have done that ever since. This is the 50th anniversary of the school that I founded, Offshore Sailing School, that we founded in 1964, and that was before there really were any sailing schools, and before anybody had written any textbooks on how to sail. So I've written a number of textbooks on sailing. And how to sail, mm-hmm. and have a progression on learning how to sail. So that was what got me started in sailing, and then I got into the 63 Pan American Games down in São Paulo, Brazil, as an alternate, and then the 68 Olympics on 5.5 meters.
So you talked a little bit about how your father had been in the Olympics. Did you have any other sports role models or sports heroes when you were growing up?
Not really. I mean, I wasn't in the sports that had those role models, you know. Mm-hmm. I was in sort of unpopular little sports like soccer and sailing. Mm-hmm. Paul Elvstrom was the Danish sailor who won so many gold medals in the Olympics was a role model, not a role model, but certainly someone to look up to in my sport.
Mm-hmm. Well, who were some of the other people that you looked up to early on in your sport?
Well, probably Bus Mosbacher, Briggs Cunningham, Peter Barrett was very instrumental in my sport. He unfortunately died fairly young, but he won a gold medal and a silver medal, I believe, in the Olympics. And he won in the 68 Olympics. He won with Lowell North in the stars. And after that, he said to me, "Why don't you and I get together and get into Flying Dutchman for the next Olympics? You skipper, and I'll crew for you." And that was a wonderful thought. But I lived in New York, and he lived in Wisconsin, so it didn't really pan out.
Tell me about the 68 trials. What was the process there, and did you encounter any challenges?
Well, 68 trials, I was with Gardner Cox in 5.5 meters. I'd been sailing as a crew in 5.5 meters for a number of years, mostly with Ernie Fay from Texas, Houston, Texas. And I was in the 64 Olympic trials. I had been stationed in Japan, in Tokyo, in 1960, as an officer in the Air Force, and I wanted to go back as a competitor for the 64 Olympics, and unfortunately we got like second place to another boat, where's this leading? I forgot. I'm almost 80 years old, so I've forgotten what
you were just explaining the trials, how you ended up at the 68 trials.
Yes, right. Okay, so I got asked by Ernie Fay had tried the 60 trials and the 64 trials, and we were second because of a mistake that he shouldn't have made, and it's sort of like always a bridesmaid, never a bride. So I decided that when I was asked by Gardner Cox, who had a very good boat, he wasn't as rich as Ernie Fay, but he asked me to crew for the Olympic trials, and I said yes, I would, and we won the Olympic trials and beat Ernie Fay. I think he was second or third in the Olympic trials, so it was the best choice. But we were out. 5.5 meter is a design boat, and we won the Olympic trials because we knew our boat so well, or Gardner did, knew the boat so well, that we got like two firsts and two seconds in the first four races, so we were almost unbeatable. So we went downhill as some of the newer boats got into the swing of things, and we finished like eighth in the Olympics because of it. But just going to the Olympics was special. Trials were in Newport Harbor in California, and it was interesting. They assigned a kid to each boat to take care of the crew of each boat, and I hope that we instilled in them the Olympic spirit, the one that was assigned to us, who's a nice little kid.
Mm-hmm.
And it was back in those days, you know, I remember seeing the incongruity of, you remember the old Volkswagen buses?
Yes.
That were all over the place there. So my wife and I, I was 68, I wasn't married then, but I was driving, I think she was out, my fiance was out there. Anyway, we were driving along, and this Volkswagen bus was in the median, and there were the occupants of the bus were a man and a woman, more of a boy and a girl. And they were standing outside this bus. It was painted all over with love, 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 you know. And they were having fisticuffs. And I thought, oh, Jesus, that's one sign of love, isn't it? But that was the incongruous thing I saw out there. I thought, well, that's California for you.
Yeah. that is a very fitting description and story about California, for sure. So I wanted to ask about how your friends and family reacted to finding out that you were going to be in the Olympics.
That I don't know. I see your one of your points here is acclimation to altitude, and I got that at cocktail parties when I came back. People were asking me how did the altitude affect me. Of course, we were at sea level, sailing in Acapulco.
Right.
But I don't, you know, my family was very proud, I'm sure, mm-hmm. but they're pretty reserved people, so I didn't get a great deal of hurrahs. Mm-hmm. I guess just expected of me.
Oh, my gosh. So who was your best friend on the team? Was it the person you sailed with, or were you friendly with other people on the Olympic team?
Yeah, well, I think Peter Barrett was one of my best friends, but the Dragon sailors were a great group of sailors. Buddy Friedrichs was a skipper, and Barton Janke and Click Schreck. I learned so much just by competing in these races and these regattas, and I saw Buddy Friedrichs and Dragon. They had started ahead of us, and they were going for the finish. I saw him duck under the sterns of three right-of-way boats and finish first. And so those three right-of-way boats were ahead of him at that time, but he went to the proper end of the finish line, was the downwind end of the finish line, and he finished first, beating all three of them. So it was a very instrumental thing that I learned about the importance of determining which end of the finish line is the nearest.
Mm-hmm.
So also, they were sort of they're fun-loving. They're all from New Orleans, and they were a fun-loving group, and Click Schreck was a great practical joker. And you know, when you do Olympic trials and you have your boat is going to be the same boat's going to be in the Olympics, and you have favorite sails. For instance, Buddy had a favorite spinnaker, a big downwind sail, and he won with it. Well, Click Schreck was a sailmaker; he'd made that spinnaker. And so they get down to Acapulco, and they go out practicing, and they put up a spinnaker, and Buddy says, this isn't the spinnaker we won with, is it? And Click said, oh, no, it's not. This is a new spinnaker I made just for this. You know, this is going to be better than the one we won with. And, of course, that's really, for poor Buddy was just in beside himself, and came back, and then they went ashore, and of course they put the sails away, and there's the spinnaker that he wanted all the time in the you know, storage area. Sort of you know, interesting sideline things for Buddy and Click.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you remember hearing anything about possible protests or boycotts by members of the U.S. Olympic team, particularly like the members of the U.S. track team, before the start of the games?
No, because we're in Acapulco and they're all in Mexico City.
Mm-hmm.
And we went for the opening ceremonies, but that's the only contact we had with anybody,
mm-hmm.
except our team.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our sailing team.
So were you aware at all of any discord or issues that were going on with the 68 team at the time?
No.
Mm-hmm. And so the student protests in Mexico City that happened about 10 days before the start of the game, I know you were in Acapulco, but did you hear anything about the student protests before the start of the games?
Well, you know, I'm not. I may have, but I don't remember it being something we were worried about. We were gonna, you know, we were there to sail In the Olympics off Acapulco, I didn't see anything, any student protests were going to stop that.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember whether we had knowledge of it or not. I mean, certainly didn't. I didn't speak Spanish well enough or read Spanish well enough to read papers about it.
Mm-hmm. What were your impressions of Mexico City and of Acapulco when you first arrived?
Well, we only got to Mexico City for the opening ceremonies. We bussed up and went right to the ceremonies and right back. So
okay.
I had no impression of Mexico City to speak of, except it seemed to be sprawling and big. And Acapulco, of course, was a resort area. And I thought the venue was very good, except it's very light winds. In our class, the Swedish fellow won our class with multiple first places in very light winds, and he was very used to light wind sailing. And he was 66 years old, which I thought was very interesting. That a person that you know, I'm 79 now, but back then I was 33, and I thought, well, someone is twice my age is wins a gold medal. That's fabulous. Great for the sport of sailing. The interesting thing, our crew member, see if the 5.5 meter has three people. Gardner Cox was skipper. Stu Walker was my fellow crew member. And Stu is a very, very good sailor and has written numerous books on sailing, more competitive sailing. He and his wife, Frances, were able to live in a hotel nearby. And I think we lived in a hotel too, but we were single anyway, Stu and Frances were coming down in the elevator at one point to go sailing. And Frances noticed that the third person in the elevator was had topsider boating shoes on. And so she said, she was a very gregarious person. She opened up the conversation, said, well, are you part of the team? And he said, yes, yes. And he said, what sailboat are you sailing on? He was American, you know. What sailboat are you sailing on? Oh, I'm on the 5.5 meter. Well, of course, there's only three of us on the 5.5 meter. There's only one of them in the race, one, you know, American boat in the race. So I thought that was a funny little thing in the elevator.
Yeah. So did you ever find out who that guy really was?
We had no idea who it was. I asked Francis, well, why didn't you say, you know, you're talking to the crew of the 5.5 meter and you're really a ghost on our boat? But she didn't say anything to him, and I guess he thought he was getting away with it.
Oh my gosh, the nerve. That's really funny. Any other memories of kind of impressions of Acapulco and the people there?
Well, I guess, you know, as it was, it's a sports thing in that we saw a bunch of these parachute towing things. What do you call them?
Paragliding?
Parasailing?
Parasailing, yes.
Anyway,
thank you.
It's towed behind a speedboat, and there are high rises, you know, hotels and so on along the waterfront there. And it looked to me like it was pretty dangerous. And then we heard a few years later that somebody, they went too close to the waterfront, and somebody was killed crashing into one of the buildings there. So that was one impression I had. Other impressions, you know, not too much about Acapulco. I mean, I remember seeing all those jeeps, sort of pink jeeps, I think, from the a resort nearby, but not too much about Acapulco itself.
Mm-hmm. What was the food situation like, and did you or anyone you know have any problems eating or drinking there during the Olympics?
Yes, our skipper did, and I don't know how we would have done much better if it hadn't been, but you know, when you're trying to steer a boat and you got stomach cramps and stuff like that, and you're out for hours at a time, it's got to be awful hard on him. And he did. I didn't have any, and Stu Walker, my other crew member, didn't have any problems. But every time I've gone to Mexico since that time, and my brother lives in Oaxaca, Mexico now as a retiree, and every time I go down there, I come back with it, with problems.
Yeah.
Problems.
Well, I'm glad you didn't. That didn't happen to you during the Olympics.
I am too.
Steve, what are your memories of the opening ceremony? Is there anything vivid about that ceremony that has stuck with you throughout these years?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember whether it was the Pan American Games opening ceremonies or the Olympic opening ceremonies. Went, you know, around the track and end up in the middle of the thing, and there were a whole bunch of doves that were set off, you know, and I think it might have been the Pan American Games, but the guy next to me was a track and field guy, and all of a sudden he got smacked with some guano from one of the doves, and he said, "God, this is a hell of a way to start the Olympics or Pan American Games. Why did it have to pick me?" But so that's, I'm not sure whether that was the Olympics. I think it was probably Sao Paulo.
Did you have any memorable interactions or experiences with people from other countries, from other national teams?
Yes, you have down your list of Cold War interactions and Soviet athletes and so on. I'd sailed against Soviet athletes quite a lot in 5.5 meters. In Suwanee, Oyster Bay, Long Island, we had the 5.5 meter Worlds, I believe it was, and the Soviets brought a team there, and it was very interesting. They had they were very gregarious, or at least one of them was, and heavy drinkers, and boy, they really put it away. And they had a coach who must have been KGB. I mean, he was a really fishy-eyed guy at a dining room table. If he saw one of them was drinking too much, his eyes were darting back and forth, watching them all the time, and he'd tap his glass and cut them off, you know. And they, you know, if they drank too much the previous night, he'd have them up really early doing exercises the next morning. But down at Acapulco, actually the five fives, one of them was the same person who had been in Suwanee. And I asked him, you know, what are you doing? Back then it was all amateur, if you know, of course, know. That was Avery Brundage, and he was very much in for the amateur sport. No one could be paid or anything like that. But the I said, "What are you going to do when you finish the Olympics here?" And he said, "Well, we get a week off." I said, "What a week off? You mean you go back to work?" He said, "This is my work. You know, we go back to sailing, and then that for the next Olympics or the next World Championships or World whatever, you know." But that he could speak English fairly decently. But that was the proof of the pudding that they were professionals, not amateurs.
Right, absolutely. With 1968 being an important time for the Cold War and the height of Vietnam, did you feel any of the effects of this political climate at the Olympics?
Not really. I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
We did have some, sailing changed a lot because of the 68 Olympics, and it was because of our Finn sailor named Carl Van Dyne. And Carl was a good friend of mine, and he's deceased too. He got cancer, and he was probably one of the healthiest people I've ever known. Vegetarian and ran every day, and extremely healthy and fit. But unfortunately, cancer can take the good and the bad. And Carl had very, very high moral standards. And they had umpires. They weren't umpires, but they had people stationed at the marks to make sure that no one hit a mark. But they didn't have they didn't have the ability to, if you hit the mark, tell them to retire or kick them out of the race. But back then, if you hit a mark, you were disqualified. And Carl went to a round mark in the Finn. It's a single-handed boat, and he accidentally touched the mark with his mainsail. The guy who was watching never saw it. And Carl retired from that race, and so he didn't do very well in the Olympics, but because that was, once you retire from a race, that's a big hit. And then the Italian sailor, a few races later, laid his sail all over a mark, and the observer called him for it, and they went in a protest meeting, and the sailor said, "No, I never touched the mark." And back then, it was your word was your bond, and they exonerated him because he said he didn't touch the mark, even though the observer saw it, let him lay the sail all over the mark. So here's two extreme cases. One, no one saw Carl hit the mark, touched the mark, and he retired. The other one laid a sail all over it and didn't retire. And so they then changed the rules. The International Sailing Federation changed the rules so that if you touched the mark, you could do a 360-degree penalty rounding. And and then go on sailing. So that was a major change in the rules from just being self-governing to being able to exonerate yourself by hitting a mark.
Yeah, that's interesting. Testing for banned and performance-enhancing substances. So, were you aware that they were doing drug testing at the Olympics?
Absolutely not. I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't worry about it.
Yeah.
No sailor was going to be taking drugs.
So you didn't know anyone that was tested?
No.
Mm-hmm. What about,
I don't know if they did test any sailors. That may have just been up in Mexico City.
That's true.
I didn't know that was. We weren't told by our coach or the team manager that this was happening. The team manager was Paul Smart. He was in his 80s then, a really nice guy.
Did you say you weren't told or you were told?
No. We were not told
Oh, okay.
That there was testing.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I remember.
Yeah. What about gender verification testing? Did you remember hearing anything about that going on at the 68 Games?
No. Is it going on now?
No, they ended it, I think, in 1992 was the last time, maybe. The Smith and Carlos protests that happened at the games, the raised fists on the medal stand. When did you find out that that had happened?
That what had happened?
That Smith and Carlos, the track, the U.S. track members who stood on the medal stand and raised their fists.
Raised the fist?
Yeah. When did you find out about that?
I think when I got back home.
Was it through the media or through some other way?
Yeah, it would be through the media. I didn't know. It would be through the media.
And what did you think about
we
that?
We were pretty isolated down there. Well, what did I think about it? You know, I think the Olympics wasn't a place to be political. It's the whole idea is to try to get everybody together and have a good feeling, but I didn't think that was not the right thing to do if that's what their intent was. Now, I didn't know whether raising the fist could have been just a feeling of feeling of elation or something like that. But, you know, I'm not aware of the meaning. I mean, was it at the time? I don't remember whether it was a rebellion signal or something.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you speak to those athletes now, it was just like a protest gesture, having to do with unequal treatment of athletes at colleges, mainly.
I see.
And then also, you know, this part of the civil rights movement, just trying to point to unequal treatment of American citizens. Other memorable or meaningful experiences that you had during the games, does anything come to mind? For example, were you able to go to and watch any other events at all, or were you just located in Acapulco?
No, we weren't. We were isolated. We were out in Acapulco, and the events were so far away that we couldn't see any of the others. But we had at the very end of the Olympics, sailing Olympics, we had a cocktail party that everybody attended, and it was fairly staid, you know, with you know, everybody had jackets and ties on, and it was interesting that an Australian named Bob Miller, who I'd met there, and who was, I believe, on the Flying Dutchman, skipper of the Flying Dutchman, or a crew on the Flying Dutchman for Australia. He was quite a character, and he decided that he was going to liven up the cocktail party. So he goes to the nearby bullfighting arena, and somehow enlisted the bullfighting orchestra to come down to our party and lighten it up. So in comes Bob Miller leading this band, and the only song they knew was the bullfight song, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they went over and over and over with this song, you know. But Bob Miller... I learned later when he went back to Australia, evidently was in a big fracas with a divorce, and his divorce lawyer suggested that he change his name, so he changed it to Ben Lexon. And most everybody in the sailing community knows Ben Lexon because he created the keel that caused Australia to win the America's Cup. And so he was a great designer also.
Interesting.
that was a very interesting thing. Very interesting to be that close to a fellow who really made his mark in sailing after the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
By a different name. I knew him as Bob Miller, and then he became Ben Lexon.
Wow. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, were you able to have any type of closing ceremony there in Acapulco?
Well, there were just... No. That was a closing ceremony, I think, a cocktail party.
Okay.
There were just the medal awards for those who had won
mm-hmm.
medals, and I was very pleased that Peter Barrett and Lowell North had won gold medals, and I was very pleased that that Buddy Friedrichs and Martin Janke and Click Schreck had won a gold medal.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do after the games completed? Like right afterwards?
That was right afterwards?
Yes.
Came back to New York. I had started my sailing school 4 years before, offshore sailing school, and just went back to working at that.
Mm-hmm.
I went over to England in 1971. For Admiral's Cup racing and some ocean racing. I did 1976 Olympic trials in Solings, but didn't do too much in small boats after that, but did quite a lot of racing in larger boats.
Mm-hmm. So you're one of the rare Olympic athletes that is still involved in their Olympic sport and has been able to be involved in the Olympic sport throughout your whole life. So is that just something special about sailing and a few other sports? And how do you feel about still being involved in the sport that you began so many years ago and in which you went to the Olympics for?
Well, to me, it's very exciting to still be involved in it. I mean, obviously at 79, you're not as agile or anything like that. And I haven't been able to do a great deal of sailing, though my crew member, Stuart Walker, is now, I think, 90 years old, and he's still sailing.
Hmm.
But he's just a very special person. And what I'm doing a lot more is this is our 50th anniversary, so we're doing a celebrity pro-am regatta. We've designed a Colgate 26 sailboat that we use in all our locations. We have seven branches, and we are going to have in January of 2015 a program regatta with 10 really high good sailing celebrities who I think there are about six Olympic medals between them, and donate $1,500 of the entry fee. We're not going to make anything on the entry fee, but the $1,500 of each entry fee will go to LLS, Leukemia Lymphoma Society. We've been big backers of the LLS for a number of years now. Started with Gary Jobson, who's a sailor friend of mine, who was the spokesperson for LLS and wanted to find out if we'd do a regatta for a thank you regatta for the LLS donors, which we did, and we've done four of them now. We donate our boats and our staff and everything to make that happen, and we've been able to give about $25 of almost each course student to LLS, so it's amounted to over $100,000 in the past 4 or 5 years. So it's not just in-kind donations, but it's actual cash donations. So that is, this has allowed me to be able to do this, you know, without having this school and the boats and staff and everything. We'd never be able to help out and give back to the extent that we have.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
So we, as Doris and I are, and Doris is my wife, and she's been very instrumental in making this school successful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a personal thing. It's Steve and Doris Colgate's Offshore Sailing School, as we're known by, that there's no way we can really sell it and get, you know, enough for it that would be able to support our lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something where I guess we'll just go on until we can't.
Yeah.
But it's a very rewarding thing. We now have generations of sailors, people who learned to sail back in the 60s with us. Now their grandchildren are learning to sail with us.
Oh, amazing. That's wonderful.
It's been terrific to have a sport we can carry on with.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent we... Mm-hmm.
Steve, I want to ask you about amateurism. You talked a little bit about Avery Brundage and how strict he was on the rules of amateurism during his reign on the International Olympic Committee. What are your feelings about amateurism and sports and amateurism in the Olympics in particular?
Well, back when I did it, and it was a purely amateur, I was asked to crew for Gardner Cox, I think, January, February of the year of the Olympics. And so May came around, I think it was May that we had our first regatta, first practice sailing and regatta. And then, of course, the Olympic trials, I think, were in end of June or something like that. I forget when the Olympics were. When were they?
In October. Mid-October.
October?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Anyway, that was the extent of, you know, of being involved in the run-up to the Olympics. It was May to October. And now, with professionalism, these kids are going... they finish one Olympics and they start working. They're like the Russians. They start working towards the next one and trying to raise money to be able to survive. And I'm an old guy and I sort of like it the way it was. You know, change is tough.
Yeah.
I think that I would hate to have to live my whole life in an Olympic sport, training and working towards the Olympics. And that's what it is for, you know, professional sailors nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would also turn you off. I mean, I remember swimming in college, and 3 years of swimming in college was enough for me. To not want to do it anymore.
Because of the schedule required?
Or? Yeah, because of the effort it required.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough sport, but I think, you know, an awful lot of tough sports. I can't, you know, thinking of rowing crew sports that terribly hard on people. And Al Orter was I guess one of my heroes back then. He lived down here in, I'm in Fort Myers, Florida, and he lived in Estero or Naples, Florida, just a few miles down the road. And he started Art of the Olympians down here. And he was an amazing guy. I don't know how he kept it up. I think it was 3 gold medals in the Olympics or 4. Al Order, he did the, what do you call it, the shot put.
Mm-hmm. Good.
But anyway, I think that whether, I think it had to go professional to grow, and everything needs to, you know, change. It had to go that way. It made, I think, when it was amateur, it was very, very hard to know what to do. I mean, I had this, had a school back then, and I remember asking some of our students to come for just a little wine and cheese party to send off for me to go to the Olympics. And they wanted to give me $20 bills and so on. And I said, no, I'm amateur. I can't take money for this. So I think it was difficult to know the dividing line between amateur and non-amateur. For instance, I was working with crewing for Ernie Fay, who's a Houston millionaire. He offered to take he offered me to crew for him in the Naples World Championships one summer, and I was just getting into, I think it was probably the summer of 65 or something like that, and I was just getting into getting my business started, and I said I couldn't do it, but that I also was wondering whether, you know, accepting his complete I didn't have any money, and he was going to pay for the airfare and the hotel and all expenses and so on, and I was afraid also that that would make me a professional instead of an amateur.
Mm.
So now anything goes, I guess. So you don't have that concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure it's nice not to have those kinds of concerns anymore.
Yes, but then there are other concerns. You know, how are we going to live, eat?
Yeah. So, Steve, what has been the impact of being an Olympian on your life?
Well, it certainly has helped, I believe, an awful lot of things that helped us make a successful school. We're probably the most successful sailing school in the United States, but there's no school that is owned or managed by an Olympian who also has done 6 transatlantic races, has done 2 Sydney Hobart races, has done races all over the world on maxi yachts as a principal helmsman, all sorts of things. Plus, I was an English major at Yale, and I was able to write books about textbooks in a reasonable way to back up the what we teach, and I learned I also was part of the U.S. Sailing Training Committee, which is the national governing body of sailing for the United States, U.S. Sailing, had all sorts of background that's helped me be a leading sailing school, and the Olympics certainly helped there, and I'm occasionally asked to give talks, but not on the Olympics, only talk. Like yesterday, I did a talk on the 1979 Fastnet race. We had our own boat in that, a 54-foot ocean racing boat. And in 1979, there was a unforecast storm that came through and killed 19 people died on the race. It was one of the most famous storms that happened in history of sailboat racing. And so I went through that, and we won our class, and I have a talk about that that's been very well received. But that was 1979, so that's a long time ago, too.
Mm.
So I guess that's your answer.
Yeah, that works. What advice, this is the last question that I'm going to ask, but what advice would you give to today's Olympic hopeful?
Today's Olympic hopeful, it's all a matter of passion. It's a matter of the best advice I would have would be that whoever you're competing against is still just a person, and they're not unbeatable. They can always be beaten. For instance, Paul Elvstrom is probably the most famous sailors of our time back then, and Paul Elvstrom was a Finn sailor. I think in the 68 Olympics, I think he was there, or at least in a pre-Olympic regatta. And he rounded a mark and led the whole fleet to the wrong mark. Everyone is following Paul Elvstrom because he is the greatest sailor in the world, except I think one other person who thought for himself and went to the correct mark and won the race.
Hmm.
So it's a matter of, and I've found that an awful lot in sailboat racing, that you need to think for yourself. Following the fleet is not going to win the race. So even the greatest can fail. And no matter what sort of circumstances you're in, there's always a cheerier day the next day. And so it's a matter of just being persistent and follow your passion.
Sounds like very good advice.
Well, thank you.
Steve, is there anything else that you would like to tell me about or that you'd like to get on this record?
Gee, I think we've covered the whole gamut. Almost an hour, so I hope you are able to cut it down to something usable. So,
oh, absolutely. It's been very, very useful and wonderful to speak with you. Very interesting as well.
Thank you.
Thank you for being generous with your time.
No, I got plenty of it. I hope.